Alain de Botton, it is great to have you here with us for Booktopia with your new book, The Course of Love, which I absolutely adore.
Thank you.
So many things that we could talk about with this book. The first thing that occurred to me was that, in a way, a relationship is a little bit like, a marriage is a little bit like buying a house. People don't check enough, do they, about the foundations and whether they're solid. Do you agree with that analogy?
Yes. I mean, generally, we go into it with instinct. And we used to have this notion that marriage should be something you go into for reasons, you know, logical reasons. And, you know, in the days of arranged marriages, people would look into your finances, your suitability, according to certain criteria. Now, those criteria were often cold and distant from the reality of marriage, and that's why we did away with them. And that's what the movement is called Romanticism, that kind of freed us from these older sort of so-called reasonable marriages. But it's left us with this quite bizarre suspicion of thorough investigation of the motives for which people enter into relationships. It is seen as quite literally unromantic to ask too many questions. I mean, if a friend introduced you to a couple and you said, so, you know, you said quite nicely, you said, so why are you getting together? I mean, what is it that... This would be seen, unless you really, you know, had a certain tone, it would be quite quickly seen as a little too inquisitorial and...
Except don't you think, Alain, that internet dating has sort of put a wedge into that argument, in the sense that now on internet sites you can ask for all sorts of information, and in fact the way you sell yourself on the internet requires you to do a kind of pitch, which in a way is not an entirely romantic spiel, is it?
Look, I don't have huge experience of internet dating, but from what I understand of the average profile, it is an advertisement for yourself, but it's not a particularly psychological attempt. I mean, you'll describe your interests and your whatever, and really it's a selling tool. Really what you're saying is, I'm a lovely, wonderful person. If I was running a dating site, you would also have a category where you're going, in what way am I a slightly crazy person?
Yeah.
In what way am I a difficult person? In what way will you find me difficult to live with? But, you know, we tend not to have the stomach for this because... Well, you know, it's not really a seller's market, so you have to be a little careful about what you put on there. So, in fact, internet dating merely increases our impatience and our desire to find this mythical unicorn-like creature called the right person, and this obsession with the right person is such an enemy of workable long-term relationships, because of course no one is right for us in that sense of being our sort of twin and, you know, psychological brother or sister, totally in the way that we might want it to be.
I have to say that now that I've put that question to you, I'm thinking that the Alain de Botton dating site would be a real hit, because you would be able to design it so that you could say, this is the bit where you tell us your particular craziness and all your flaws, so that they're advertised, you know, so that we know what we're getting into. I think that would have a lot of appeal. Now, Romanticism. This was a movement that, it seems to me, was invented by men, and yet in the consumer society that we live in, I think that women are generally the ones who are addressed as consumers with the sort of romantic accessorizing, the endless sort of red roses and all the sorts of accoutrements of courtship are directed at women, aren't they? So can you just talk a little bit about the sort of romantic push-pull between whether men are in fact the more romantic gender or are women?
That's interesting. I mean, others have said that, you know, Romanticism did give women a voice for the first time, and rather than simply seeing them as... Because, in a way, as soon as love's seen as an emotional currency, rather than... Or relationships are kind of understood via the emotional aspect of them, rather than merely the financial, the legal, then women start to have a voice. And you start to see that in the novels of the 19th century, where suddenly how women feel for the first time is a really important part of how a relationship's going to go. So, you know, there is some sort of female empowerment, but there is also a horrible trap for both genders, which is that ultimately, you know, the cult of romanticism doesn't give people the tools necessary to sustain a long-term, emotionally close relationship, which is actually something that we nowadays are brought up to want, but are given no clue as to how we're going to get it. And we are a society that loves to plan for everything and that has manuals in every area, except for this one, rather oddly. And you know, I read a statistic the other day that something like 70% of a person's happiness in and life satisfaction is down to their relationship. And if a Martian were to look at that statistic and then look at how humans actually behave, what they spend their money on, what they spend their time on, you're thinking, oh, really? So how does, you know, it seems like your car must surely be, you know, determined, most because, you know, most people spend more time in their car, on their car, money on their car, etc., etc. So there's a curious, yeah, we've abandoned this topic to chance. And I think for me, you know, why did I write a novel about this? For me, fiction has some of the blame to bear for this, because I think that we're not telling each other the right sort of stories about love, and we're slightly running into the sands often because of our sense of what is normal and to be expected in relationships that doesn't match the reality, and that makes us more impatient and ill-tempered with one another.
But there are writers who counter the sort of romantic idealism with a cooler, rational head. I'm thinking of writers that I like Ian McEwan, Julian Barnes, a lyricist like Tim Minchin writing a love song to his wife called If I Didn't Have You, ... I'd Probably Have Somebody Else, which is a love song all about statistical probability.
Yeah.
I mean, there are a few voices out there that are sort of counterbalancing the great big romantic monolith.
Absolutely. You're right. I think they are minority voices. I think the other thing that happens is that there are the voices of cynicism. An extreme cynicism, which I'd add someone like John Updike, who you know wrote a lot about relationships, but very darkly. And I think that's what can happen when you have a very optimistic sort of mainstream culture, and then you know the alternative is a biting, you know, Martin Amis style cynicism. And I think you know, I don't know. I think what we really need is encouraging voices around love that at the same time are not sentimental.
Absolutely.
I think sentimentality is the enemy here.
Yes.
And if I think of cinema, you know, one of the films that I think captures it very well is Richard Linklater's Before Midnight. I don't know if you saw that.
Yes.
But that's one of the few films of recent years that unsentimentally portrays the level of bitterness, anger and rage that you might feel towards a partner who you also love. And I think that's the key thing.
Nora Ephron was good at that, don't you think, in a way?
Yeah.
I think she was sort of very witty about it. And that brings me to something else. Your couple in this book, In the Course of Love, Rabbi and Kirsten, they, it seems to me, are very intelligent people, but what struck me is that they lack a certain sense of humour.
And I
think that you've said elsewhere that you think humour is crucial to make the
dynamics
of marriage work long term.
Yeah.
Why did you write two characters who are so intelligent and sensitive and want to make this marriage work and deprive them of humour?
Yes, I think that's right. I think because I don't imagine that they're humourless in other areas of their life. I think they can't. It's so serious for them. It's emotionally so serious for them. They haven't learned
to lighten up.
To lighten up. And I think, you know, if I was adding a chapter now, I might add in a chapter at the end about how they learned to lighten up. Because I agree with you fully. I think that, you know, humour is what allows you to move from the feeling that your partner is an idiot or a mean person to your partner is a lovable idiot, a sweet mean person, or whatever. You know, and those words are very key additions.
Absolutely, and you can be affectionate in your teasing of someone without being hurtful.
That's
and
right.
In fact, that is often a mark of affection, isn't
it? That's right. Yes.
You said before that you think that marriage is something that most people go into without a user's manual, but there is now a lot of self-help relationship counselling. There is also pre-marriage counselling offered by the church. And I'm just wondering, you know, about the whole business, what you think about couples counselling. One of the things that a couples counsellor told me recently was a very vexed area of negotiation for couples was how much time each individual member of the couple was allowed to spend either with social media or with porn.
Right.
What's your take on that?
Well, look, I think these conversations sound really unromantic. It's like, what, you're going to make a list of rules, etc. I think that a certain degree of artifice is really important to making a relationship go well. And I know that aesthetically, almost, couples counselling is not great. It just seems, as I say, it seems unromantic. And in the book, I deliberately wanted to send them to a couples counsellor. And at one point, you know, I think I say that it seems really unromantic to be having to sort of thrash out issues like this. But at the same time, if you define romanticism as the thing that enables a relationship to go on, then this is the most romantic thing that's ever happened to them. Much more than a candlelit dinner.
Isn't it? It's a much bigger investment than a candlelit dinner.
Sure. I mean, time-wise, everything-wise. But also that the reason why it seems offensive is it's a violation of the romantic sense that true love is just an emotional impulse. It seems so artificial to have to say, ooh, you know, you can only spend 5 minutes on your phone or blah, blah, blah. But yes, I think, you know, PowerPoint presentation on how you feel about crumbs on the kitchen table, why not? Go for it. It may be what's necessary. And it's not the enemy of true emotion. It may help it. So I think our impatience with procedures and practicalities really does us a disservice.
So what do you think about porn in a marriage? Because this is now a real-life factor and issue, and you have written about porn as therapy. Mm. So what do you think are the boundaries? What are the rules around this?
Mm. I mean, so many ways to approach this. I think many people are deeply upset by the discovery that their partner has been looking at porn, both genders. It can be a very hurtful discovery. And I think, so immediately one of the things to try and do is to understand what porn is and the role that it plays. Because people will say things like, well, I knew the relationship was over. I knew it couldn't survive because a decent person doesn't look at porn. Mm. And, you know, I immediately would think, ooh, that's a pretty... Like, you're setting the bar quite high. Like, are you really sure that's the way that we should be looking at this? And I think to try and humanize you know, these things and go, okay, your partner, who's nice in a thousand ways, like, they haven't left all reason behind. Where's this coming from, etc.? It's part of... Look, I think, you know, I think what's very hurtful for many couples is that they'll find that one or the other would prefer to watch porn than to have sex with them. Mm. There are lots of reasons for this that are not, you know, demonizing reasons. It can be, you know, when a couple don't know each other that well, sex is this wonderful way of achieving closeness and of bridging the gap between two people. When that gap is entirely gone, when two people are literally welded together, sex becomes hard because there is literally no more distance between a couple. They've spent all day together, they know everything about one another, and there is no distance to appreciate and to notice. You're standing so close to someone, you can't even look at them.
And mystery is sexy.
And mystery is sexy. And I think very often people are then using porn because sex with the partner, as I say, they're so... It's not that they've stopped loving them. They love them too much. They're so invested in them. Everything is so... It's become too hard. And I think, you know, once you explain it like that, it stops being what it could otherwise seem like, which is just meanness or a sign that you're trying to ruin their life or something like this. You know, that we often leap to very dark interpretations of why partners are doing something that they're doing. And I think, you know, that... compassion can quickly run out. It's like, I knew the moment that I saw that my partner was doing this, I knew they were an evil person. It's like, oof, you know, I don't know. So I think the true work of love is really all about continuing to try and understand a partner, even in patterns of behavior that are pretty surprising to you and pretty alien to you. We do this naturally with children. You know, if a child does something quite weird, if a child suddenly writes, I hate you, all over the bathroom in crayon, you don't immediately go, okay, this child's evil.
I'm sending it back.
I don't want it. You go, okay, like, you know, because you love them. And we find it easier to know about love via children, I think. We say things like, well, we basically love this child, but, you know, something's gone wrong. Like, we've got to try and understand how this came about. So we're willing to to be quite generous in our interpretation.
We are, because we think of children as innocent, and we're giving them unconditional love easily because of that innocence. But in a mature relationship, that kind of unconditional love is much, much harder to give.
It's harder. The question is whether we should give it. And I think that, you know, Jesus and Dostoevsky would tell us that we should, and that that is what the work of love is. It's not easy. But people say, what is the hardness of love? It's that. And, you know, in the kind of Christian schema of things, it's literally that you should be able to love the leper and the prostitute and the murderer. And that is the kind of territory that Dostoevsky's novels take us in as well. And it's so... we give this very high cultural prestige, but we don't necessarily imbibe this in our own lessons. And we don't really see the links with our own lives. But I think, and it's always been my view, that, you know, things that have high cultural prestige... you know, we shouldn't just pay lip service. They should be infused into the way we live.
Well, let's move for a moment from the personal of this relationship that you've put under the microscope with such great sort of forensic fun and elegance to a bigger breakup on the world stage, which is Brexit. Mm. Is Brexit a relationship that's gone horribly, horribly wrong, where the terms were not understood and the two parties did not know each other sufficiently? I mean, obviously there's nothing remotely romantic about this, but how do you see what's happening to Britain, which is in a state of complete convulsion?
I mean, I think, you know, a question that many couples have is, when should we break up? And many couples, you know, the people in a couple sometimes feel a little unhappy about all sorts of things. And, you know, one of the questions is, where is that unhappiness coming from? Is that unhappiness really the fault of my partner? Or is it an unhappiness that might trail me wherever I go? Is it the unhappiness of just being human? And I think, you know, you should break up with somebody when you really can be sure that the unhappiness you feel is the person's fault. That if you think about everything that's dragging you down, it really is the person. And therefore, you should leave, because they are nothing but, you know, a drag on your potential. But if hand on heart, you're not really sure that the things that are making life difficult really are their fault, then you should stay, because really you've encountered the bitterness of life in the company of another person, but not caused by another person. And it's very easy to confuse in the company of with caused by. So you sort of think, you know, that person has caused the bitterness in my life, and then you throw them in the bin, and then you get together somebody else, and then you realise it's following. And you know, the desperate thought is, I think, that Britain has got a lot of problems, and yes, there is unemployment in the north, and yes, there's this, and yes, there's that, etc. The question is, let's try and identify where the thing is coming from. And unfortunately, I think what's happened is, like in a relationship that shouldn't be ending but has, someone has mounted a very successful case for the fact that all of the country's problems come from this thing called the EU. And I just don't think it's true. And I think that, you know, like a bad breakup, what's going to happen is, we'll find that many of the problems we had will continue to dog us and won't have been solved at all. And in fact, we'll have a whole new set of problems caused simply by the departure.
When you first wrote about love in a novel 20 years ago, I seem to remember that you were a bachelor. You are now married with two children. And given the fact that we see this relationship from the perspectives of both of the players, I'm wondering what your wife's reaction to the book was.
Well, she joked to me the other day that she was definitely going to stay with me till the paperback. so I'd be safe on that score, but not necessarily longer. Look, you know, marriage has been getting easier, but it's gone through some hard phases. Part of it's been easier because we have actually learnt to laugh at one another and with one another. But
are you easy to tease?
in the right way, you know. Yeah, you know, we all need to be teased. Teasing is an art; it's a skill.
Yeah.
Teasing in love is a skill. But sorry, what was your question?
I wanted to know what your wife thought of the book and whether she had any input.
She really actually liked the book, and she was its first reader. And, you know, I was a little nervous what she thought. But I think she recognised it very quickly for what it is, which is a book on the side of marriage.
Definitely.
As she's on the side of marriage, she liked it for that reason.
Yeah, you seem to be saying stick it out, but just kind of change the rules of the game. Temperamentally, you've described yourself, Alain, as being gloomy by nature. Mm. And I was wondering whether your writing and your public philosophizing make you feel more optimistic about the state of the world, or whether the kind of analysis that you subject everything to contributes to your feeling of gloom.
Look, the basic facts of life are horrific. All of us are headed to death, and everyone that we love is headed to death. So just, I mean, you don't need to know anything else other than this to know that we've all got a massive sort of bowl of pain that we're going to need to eat at some point. And it may need to come at this point in life or that point in life, but, you know, and we're incredibly vulnerable to illness, etc. And then we have these incredibly high hopes for ourselves in our careers and in our private lives, and those hopes are not going to come through unscathed. All of us suffer humiliation and setback in all these areas. So, you know, the human lot, and that's even a, just like if everything goes really quite well. So, and then it can get worse from there. So the basic facts are brutal, and, you know, you'd have to be seriously deluding yourself to be anything other than, you know, quite alive to the kind of melancholic nature of life. The thing is, what does one do? I think that the best possible response is a kind of cheerful pessimism, or a kind of, you know, a kind of an optimistic despair. And that's what I try and aim for.
Shostakovich was once asked, according to Julian Barnes, to write an optimistic tragedy.
Right. Yeah, very good. Very good. We all need that. Yeah.
Well, on that happy note, thank you very much, Alain de Botton.
Thank you.